Like, you know.
The mad side of genius. Cantona is dismissed. Where can there be a place in the game for a man of such extravagant talent, a man of such wicked temperament, a man who has been quite rightly dismissed, a man who is now just... Oh, my goodness me! He just kicks. He's punched a fan. Eric Cantona has jumped in and scissor kung fu kick.
Everybody to the Divers and Cheats Show, episode 2. Sorry, we had some technical difficulties, thanks to our web browser, Google Chrome, but they've been resolved, and we're with you just a few minutes late. My name is Carter Kushner, your host. We're going to be talking about today the topic everybody in American soccer is talking about and thinking about at this very moment, which is that October 10th playoff to qualify for the Confederations Cup, United States versus Mexico at the Rose Bowl in Los Angeles. We're going to be joined in just a moment by Neil Blackman from theyanksarecoming.com. Thank you for listening to our show. You can listen to us live on Ravel.tv, or you can listen on demand at Ravel.tv. We come to you every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, you can find us on WorldSoccerTalk.com in the podcast stream there, which includes some other great shows, including the Fantasy Football Weekly, the World Soccer Talk podcast hosted by Richard Farley, and Soccer Morning hosted by Jason Davis, as well as World Soccer Talk Radio hosted by Nate Alvarea. So without any further ado, since we lost a couple of minutes in our program already, let me bring in Neil Blackman from The Yanks Are Coming. Neil, how are you today?
I'm well, Kardik. How's it going?
Going well for any number of reasons, but one thing that didn't go so well, Neil, was the United States in the Gold Cup. And you have to look at this Gold Cup and say, obviously the United States did not reach the level of expectation and the level of performance that we've seen in previous Gold Cup competitions. Perhaps it's CONCACAF getting better, perhaps it's the U.S. slipping up, being in a down part of the cycle. However, what has happened because the United States did not win the Gold Cup in 2015 is that the United States does not qualify automatically for the Confederations Cup, which is going to be held in Russia in the summer of 2017. And, Neil, I've had some concerns about the Confederations Cup. Not concerns. I think it would be great to qualify. It would be great for the United States to go. But the U.S. program, as I see it, has put more emphasis on qualifying for the Confederations Cup and performing at the Confederations Cup maybe than any other program, international football program on the globe. And what is it? Why does U.S. soccer and some analysts like you, some people who cover the national team closely like you, feel like this is such a make or break important event for the United States to participate in?
Well, I think the obvious answer is that it just dates back to the performance of the team in 2009 in South Africa. And the fact that, forgetting that the team finished second and, you know, is a half away from winning an international trophy, but just the experience and the way some of the players and Bob Bradley spoke afterwards about the ability to go to the World Cup site for U.S. soccer, which could use its vast resources to sort of stake out training grounds that they felt like they could use the following year. They were able to secure a base camp. It's just a matter of the whole federation being comfortable with the process they were going to endure the following summer. And then, of course, you know, whatever you think of the World Cup group the U.S. was in 2010, the Americans won the group. And, you know, whether or not that had anything to do with the 2009 Confederations Cup experience, I think there's optics that suggest that's how they feel, that at least some in U.S. soccer feel like it helped. They feel like that contributed to winning the group, was a comfort level. In South Africa, Russia's the kind of country where, you know, maybe having that level of comfort, given all the travel that will be necessary for that tournament, maybe that's what the emphasis is there for again.
So given that the United States doesn't get to compete in the high-level continental competition that that other countries, particularly in South America and Europe, do, I guess there's been this emphasis on the Confederations Cup also, not just getting familiar and with the country where the World Cup's going to be hosted. But could you argue now that CONCACAF, as we saw in this Gold Cup, has reached a level where they can compete with the United States, beat the United States as Jamaica did, draw with the United States as Panama did twice in this competition, that maybe the value around the Confederations Cup may be overblown? Or do you think it has little to do with not getting great games in your own confederation?
Well, if you ask Jurgen Klinsmann about it, he says that it's about playing teams from other confederations that are better than what the U.S. faces in CONCACAF, where on any given day, they're the first or second best team in CONCACAF, almost certainly, on paper. I think that the U.S. doesn't get those sorts of matches because the U.S. doesn't play Costa Rica very often for whatever reason. So, you know, you really don't have – you have these Mexico money grab pop-up matches like the one in San Antonio, and then that's it in terms of the high-level competition. And even those matches are friendlies where you play on the type of grass they play on at the Alamo Dome. I mean, I think you're on to something with the notion that it's important for the U.S. to play competitive matches against high-level quality opponents. And the U.S. was able to do that in 2009. Yet another reason that people feel like it kind of helped the team gain confidence for the World Cup the following year. The U.S. didn't get any of those sorts of matches outside of friendlies by missing the one in Brazil. And maybe, you know, who knows? Does that affect the way the U.S. approached the Belgium match? Maybe. Certainly, no one that went to that Confederations Cup in Brazil really played particularly inspiring football at the World Cup in 2014. So it's an interesting question, I think.
So with that in mind, that premise and the importance then of the Confederations Cup to building towards the 2018 World Cup, let's dissect the Gold Cup performance for the United States and the squad selection for Jurgen Klinsmann, because could it be argued that Jurgen Klinsmann selected a stronger set of players for the friendlies in the Netherlands and in Germany, both historic victories, famous victories for the United States, than in the Gold Cup? And if that's the case, doesn't that kind of debunk the notion that we're building towards Confederations Cup qualifying? And if Confederations Cup qualifying, Neil, is kind of a two-part question for you, qualifying for the Confederations Cup, was that critical? Then why did Klinsmann leave some of the guys behind for the Gold Cup that he did?
Well, I think that the answer to the second question is more befuddling to me than maybe the first question, which is just, I thought that Jurgen Klinsmann called in a team that he felt was similar to the one that won on European soil against Germany in the Netherlands. But I felt like the team that they called in for the Gold Cup was ill-suited to play against the style of teams that they were going to face in the Gold Cup. I mean, the U.S. was going to play compact defenses and not necessarily be set up in a way where they were going to counterattack a great deal like they did in Europe. So the U.S. had to break teams down. They created the fewest shots of any side in the tournament, including Canada, who didn't score. They created the second least chances at the Gold Cup, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that there was no bite in the midfield in terms of the ability to break people down. The second answer, I think, is the interesting one. And, you know, I don't know if this necessarily answers the question, but I think this is one where Klinsmann, like this idea of Klinsmann, the master tinkerer, who's constantly tinkering with things, I think that affects continuity. I think at the end of the day, there's players have to develop an understanding of one another. And when you don't call in Aron Johansson and then you expect him to play off of spaces that Michael Bradley likes to get the ball to, you know, there's going to be moments of disjointedness. There's going to be problems in attack and in link-up play. And that's just one example, Bradley and Johansson. I mean, there's I think, plenty of other reasons and examples why the U.S. looked somewhat dysfunctional in attack at the Gold Cup. And you wonder, you know, even in the semifinal game, I mean, they played a 4-2-3-1, and they haven't played a 4-2-3-1 since the first year of Klinsmann being in charge. I mean, I don't understand why you change your lineup so much and change your formation so much. I think at some point, maybe that has a negative effect on the team's ability to play, you know, fluid football.
So you point out two very, very troubling statistics here from the Gold Cup. The U.S. had the least shots in the entire tournament, I guess that's on average per match, and the second least chances in the tournament. And that includes countries like Canada and Cuba that were and El Salvador that were very poor in this tournament. So, and we know the U.S. got outshot by Haiti. It got outshot by Panama at the group stage. And I cannot remember if the U.S. was outshot in the Honduras game, too, possibly.
They were.
Okay. So they were outshot in all three group games. And it wasn't just shots from distance. In the Haiti game, Haiti had far, far more clear-cut chances, far more dangerous chances. The U.S.'s goal was a little bit against the run of play, quite frankly, right after halftime. So with that in mind, what is it then? Do we have a player selection issue? Do we have a problem with Jurgen Klinsmann's constant tinkering? Or do we have a situation now where in our player pool, we just don't have the talent? Although that could be, you could counter that, right, by saying we created an incredible number of chances against Germany and the Netherlands in those friendlies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Gold Cup was a combination of continuity and player selection. You know, and I think that some of it is that, and then some of the Jamaica game was the U.S. not really knowing what to do against teams that were compact when behind. And if you think about it, that makes some sense, because as good as, or as bad as the U.S. have been, rather, attacking in the last really 2 years, they haven't been behind a whole bunch of times in competitive matches. I guess against Belgium, they were behind. And against Germany, they had to chase, but they almost were able to get an equalizer in that match. But the U.S. have had outshot, if you include the Gold Cup, they've outshot an opponent twice in competitive matches since they qualified for Brazil. Those matches were Cuba.
Okay.
All right. And the Panama match that sent Mexico to the World Cup. So that's it. And then, in the third place match against Panama, you can think what you want of those matches. But, I mean, Brad Guzan made more saves in that match than Tim Howard had to make against Spain in 2009.
He actually made more saves, I believe, in regular time than Howard did against Belgium in regular time.
I think he may have. I'm not certain about that. I know that he made more than the U.S. had to make against Spain. So the U.S. is doing two things that are very troubling. One, they're not creating chances. And two, they're conceding lots of chances.
Right. That's a formula for failure. So those of you listening to the show live, you can interact with us at rabble.tv on the broadcast, as some of you already have, or tweeting at me at KKFLA737, use the hashtag Divers and Cheats. Atta, our friend who hosts Turkish Football Weekly and is a frequent guest on a number of other podcasts, has said, and this is interesting, Neil, let's assess this. I would like to think that MLS has some sort of hand in the development of the game in this region. It's basically the place where CONCACAF players can head to in order to up their game. A couple quick notes. There were 45 MLS players in the Gold Cup. There were 9 players from the Second Division North American Soccer League. There were 5 players from, four players, excuse me, from the Third Division USL, including Jamaica's goalkeeper, Ryan Thompson. So mm-hmm. Comment on that. What are your thoughts? Have the U.S. league structure allowed other CONCACAF countries to maybe catch the U.S.?
I think it's helping. I mean, I don't think that anyone's really caught the U.S. I mean, the U.S. has still won the Hex to qualify, but 3 consecutive times now. The U.S. is the only country in the region to win a World Cup group this century. I don't think the U.S. is the only one to reach the quarterfinal. Well, no, Costa Rica. The U.S. is one of 2 nations to reach the quarterfinals this century. I don't think that necessarily the United States has been caught, but I think this is an interesting and troubling time for U.S. soccer, which makes that match kind of a tilting point. I don't know if one match can be a referendum on the Klinsmann era, but I think it's a really critical match because Jurgen Klinsmann has emphasized it. He's emphasized qualifying for that tournament. So the failure to do so would be a failure that Klinsmann identified as something that the U.S. would succeed in.
So he created the context. So we're clear. Klinsmann himself created the context where this match now is critical in his tenure because he said we had to qualify for this tournament.
Sure. I mean, I think that deep down, if confronted about that, if the U.S. lose, you know, I think the U.S. soccer media will ask him about that if the U.S. are beaten at the Rose Bowl. And I think Klinsmann, to his credit, will acknowledge that he put an emphasis on qualifying for this competition, and the failure to do so is a step back for the program.
Okay, so with that in mind, let's get right to that game. Let's talk about that because it is there are these exciting playoff clashes in UEFA and intercontinental clashes between CONCACAF and CONMEBOL, CONMEBOL and Oceania, what have you. We haven't had one within CONCACAF ever, and they're generally for World Cups, right? Qualify for World Cups or Euros. This is for the Confederations Cup, which makes it a little bit different, but it's a one-off. The playoffs in Europe to qualify for the Euros between third-place teams and World Cups are home and away. So this is a one-off game, massive stakes. If you buy into the premise that the Confederations Cup is important, regardless of whether you buy into the premise that it's critical for the development of the program and performance in 2018 or not, I guess you would have to concede that it's better to be there than not be there. So that puts a lot on this one game, which will be at the Rose Bowl. So let's get right to it. It'll be at the Rose Bowl, which means it'll be largely a pro-Mexican crowd, we have to assume. It is coming right in the middle of the playoff chase in Major League Soccer. It's coming in the middle of the Liga MX season, and it is in an international break where players, U.S. players who are playing in the Bundesliga and the Premier League and other leagues in Europe, the Eredivisie in the case of Aaron Johansson's now in Bundesliga, but those other leagues will have an international break. So you have a full selection. No problems, no preseason going on where there were a couple of U.S. players like Jeff Cameron, who we saw play very well at center back for Stoke this past weekend against Liverpool. He wasn't available for the Gold Cup for selection because Stoke said he's been playing every summer since he signed with us. He needs some time off, and I would agree with that if I'm looking at it from a club perspective. Danny Williams, same deal at Reading. So Klinsmann's going to have a full array of selection of players, okay? He's going to be less hamstrung than he was during the Gold Cup, minus injuries. So where do you go with this team, Neil? You've identified that possession, that creating chances was a problem, keeping possession was a problem, conceding chances is a problem, and the constant tinkering and change of formation is a problem. So let's talk about formation, and let's talk about player selection. Let's start with the formation. How do you think Klinsmann should play this one?
Well, I think they'll play I think they're going to play in this modified diamond that optimizes Michael Bradley. It doesn't have Michael playing as far forward as he would, as sort of like the tip of the diamond, like Downing plays for West Ham or Jack Wilshere was trying to play last year, but, you know, somewhat further back with some lateral help, whether that comes in the form of, you know, Kyle Beckerman and Shuttlers, or whether that comes with Sasha Kljestan even, or someone like that.
So someone like Sasha Kljestan or mixed disc group, so you don't have any wingers in that formation, correct? Your width's going to come from your fullbacks?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Jurgen Klinsmann has found guys who are necessary. And you can get width from Fabian Johnson in that formation if you choose to move him to the midfield. But, I mean, I think that we kind of can agree that Alejandro Bedoya is probably one of your best options on one side. And, you know, he's not really a pure winger. I mean, the U.S. is going to get width from their fullbacks. Anytime you play, you can play a modified diamond or a pure diamond. It's still going to be, if your fullbacks are the better fullbacks on the day, then the diamond sometimes can be very effective. And if they're not, then sometimes it can be very ineffective.
Do you play with a guy like Beckerman at the tip of a diamond, or do you call in Danny Williams, or do you just have another box-to-box midfield?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you wonder if with World Cup qualifying starting 1 month later, Clemson's kind of boxed himself in because, yes, he wants to build and look towards the future, but he also has emphasized qualifying for this tournament. So do you make this one particular match kind of a swan song for a Kyle Beckerman, or do you go to a Danny Williams who really hasn't played well against anyone other than Caribbean nations in a competitive setting? Or do you go to Morales, who hasn't really, he covers a lot of ground, but he hasn't really shown well in a U.S. shirt, period, other than running a lot. You know, I mean, what do you do there? I think it's got to be Kyle Beckerman. He's been a very good player against Mexico. That's a team that his skill set is much better suited for than Jamaica. The U.S. have to be strong in defense to have any chance in this playoff, particularly playing what you've identified as correct will be a functional road game at night against a bunch of Mexican fans who now have had a whole Saturday instead of an abbreviated Friday to get drunk.
Yeah, right. So the October 9th to October 10th date change, Neil, you and I are on the same page here. I found that very significant. I thought that was advantage Mexico by changing the date from the 9th to the 10th because the 9th, I think the crowd would have been less ruckus. Maybe it would have worked a little bit better for the U.S. Now they have a whole day to get lubricated, and it's going to be a hostile atmosphere. So let's say we're going Bradley, a guy like Bradley Bedoya for sure, I think. And then if you look at the other two midfield positions, Beckerman or that type of player, Sasha Kleiston, I like the thinking there. Very, very cultured, useful box-to-box midfielder who, for whatever reason, and maybe we'll get into this with Jurgen's preferences and thought process about the team in general, for whatever reason, hasn't been a favorite of this manager. Has been, even though he was playing Champions League football for Anderlecht not that long ago and has had a remarkable impact in Major League Soccer this year. I mean, I would argue New York Red Bull have not dropped off, even though they lost Thierry Henry and Timmy Cahill because of Kleiston's play and also the play of Bradley Wright Phillips, and now they've got Sean Wright Phillips also, who's kind of like having a DP in a sense with that team. So let's look at the forwards. Is it as simple as Dempsey Johansson, or does Jozy Altidore have a shout here, or somebody else maybe?
I think it's as simple as Dempsey Johansson. You know, maybe if Jozy finds his form here in the next, I mean, I think Jurgen Klinsmann sent him home to kind of put him in timeout and say, hey, get your head right, get your game together, because it hasn't been right for a year and a half. But when Jozy Altidore is right, it's the closest thing the U.S. have had forward-wise to a goal scorer, to a Brian McBride type. And they, you know, there are guys that the U.S. is going to find extraordinarily difficult to replace, period. Brian McBride has been one of those guys. Steve Cherundolo will be one of those guys, and is probably already one of those guys. Jozy Altidore, when in form, is the closest thing they can do to that. So, yeah, I think if he's playing well, he's going to get a look. He has to get a look. What do you think?
I'm guessing that's the case. I mean, I think Johansson runs the channels well, but he's not necessarily a guy that's shown that he can score goals at this level. He doesn't give you something completely different as a look from Dempsey as Altidore would. And the U.S., it's so important to have that guy that holds up play. You mentioned Steve Cherundolo. This gets to some of the selection headaches for Jurgen Klinsmann. He doesn't have a guy that's as experienced and has played consistently at as high a level at a club in Europe as Steve Cherundolo right now in this national team. So as we move forward, would you like to see more of these guys try their luck in Europe at a younger age and maybe try and stick through with a club? I mean, I don't know that we're going to have another American that plays 15 years for one club like Cherundolo did, but that's probably never going to – it just doesn't happen in this sport very much, American or non-Americans. But Cherundolo went to Europe at a very young age, got into the Hanover system, and became a club legend. Do we need to have more guys doing this and going to the right clubs, not necessarily signing with big clubs like Spurs where you're never going to play if you're DeAndre Yedlin?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm interested to see what Emerson Hyman does just because his he was a part of that U-20 side that probably was the first U-20 side to play well since Tomas Rongen's group did in 2007. I thought they played a really nice brand of soccer for most of their matches in New Zealand. He's a highly technical player. He's really polished in terms of, you know, his ability on the ball. And more importantly, I think at that age, just the way he reads the game is just understanding of what's happening around him, I think, is highly advanced. And he says he wants to leave Fulham, to which I kind of respond, why? You know, playing time's guaranteed at Craven Cottage. Maybe he doesn't like his manager. Maybe he thinks the championship isn't where he can develop. But, you know, I would warn against going anywhere where you're not necessarily going to see the field for the reasons that you've identified. Maybe a Rubio Rabin is that kind of player at 19, you know? He's an interesting thought when it comes to October and this, like, debate between youth and veterans, because Rabin is another guy who can get out wide, who can get in the channels, who can set up a scoring forward, but maybe, like, Johansson isn't necessarily a goal scorer at heart. Do you give that kind of guy a look in a match that big? And Jurgen Klinsmann has proven to be one thing and above all, and that's pragmatic. And to some extent, conservative when the stakes are the highest. I mean, I just think it'll be vets then. But to answer your question, yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. There are two or three players in Europe now. It will be interesting to see, you know, where they go and whether they stay at places like Fulham where they can grow.
So, given that you think that it's going to be vets, do you think that means we're going to see DeMarcus Beasley again pulled out of international retirement, or I guess his international retirement now is over, it's open, whatever the case. He'd come back, play left back in that game. Brad Davis, who was called into this to the Gold Cup but then got injured, who is even when he was a younger player, was a very slow player to play out on the wing, but he's a great crosser of the ball and hits a great dead ball with his left foot. Guy like him, are we going to see Brad Evans again at right back? Is Klinsmann going to pick a squad that just gets him through this game or tries to get him through the game? So we're going to see a lot of these types of veteran players, recycled players in some cases?
Well, he has to fix the defense, okay? So, you know, John Brooks and Ventura Alvarado is not going to get the U.S. to the Confederations Cup. And if that's the center back pairing when I'm staring down at the Rose Bowl on October 10th, I'm going to at least tell anyone around me that the U.S. is probably going to lose. It needs to be – that's where you go with a Jeff Cameron, who just showed exceptionally well for Stoke and is going to get plenty of chances with Ryan Shawcross hurt. That's where, you know, you might look at DeMarcus Beasley, who's playing really well for Houston, by the way. Scored this weekend, knows those Mexico players, knows what they want to do out wide. If Gio Dos Santos is healthy, there's a guy that knows that Gio Dos Santos is going to in cut onto his right foot, right? That's DeMarcus Beaton. He's a guy who's going to know that Mexico likes to pump balls at the far post. You know, who's going to have that post covered? DeMarcus Beasley, just like he did against Ghana. So, yeah, I mean, I think Jurgen's going to go with veterans that he trusts. Does he trust Jeff Cameron? Well, he should over John Brooks, who's terrible in the air at 22, despite being 6'4". And Ventura Alvarado, who just gets abused 1v1 right now.
Yeah, it's very odd, the Cameron situation, because he's the one player, field player for the United States consistently playing in the Premier League, whether he's playing right back or center back. Yeah, he's generally playing right back, and Klinsmann doesn't like him as right back. But he did play center back this weekend against Liverpool, as you mentioned, and he had a very good game. Shawcross is out. Shawcross is one of the best center backs in the Premier League. At least that doesn't play for a big club. And although some would argue Stoke is now a big club as an aside, they have more Champions League winners in their squad than any other team in England, believe it or not. I don't know why Cameron has never seemingly been played at center back for the United States. Is there something that between the lines that we don't know about? Because that would be an obvious choice. And then I think you go back to either Beasler or Gonzalez to pair with him. Or maybe Jermaine Jones, if he's fit.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be Jermaine Jones. He just goes walkabout too much. But, you know, I can pick on Brooks and Alvarado's individual flaws technically right now, and those things are going to get better. Both those guys are immense talents. But, there's something to be said. This goes back to the continuity point, though, doesn't it? I mean, who's played together? Who has an understanding? Beisler and Cameron, Beisler and Gonzalez. These guys have understanding. Jeff Cameron played extraordinarily well in at least one of the World Cup matches at that position. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting question as to whether or not, I don't know if Jurgen Klinsmann doesn't trust him. I just think that Jurgen, again, this the tinkering, he moves him around so much that maybe Jurgen doesn't know where he trusts him. Jeff Cameron is a good player, but where?
Right, so he's got him in kind of the Benny Olsen mindset that Bob Bradley and Bruce Arena and Ben Olsen, and I don't know where to play him, but I want him on the squad because I can plug him in somewhere late in games. So let's talk about Klinsmann. Let's transition here. You're talking about tinkering. He's got squad selection issues. He keeps making, it seems, mistakes in squad selection, changes tactics frequently. He is also the guy responsible for the grand vision for U.S. soccer to get us from this situation where we're getting out of the group in the World Cup with 4 points or 5 points, kind of this 4 point and pray mentality, which has been pervaded U.S. soccer since 2002. 4 points and pray, you're going to get 4 points in a group and get out and hope you're set in second to that next level. That's been his task. Now, he's got both the technical director's role and the coach's role. Are those two roles bleeding together? And if so, Neil, do you think that there needs to be some sort of division between them? And is it possible for Jurgen Klinsmann to divide those roles and keep doing both those jobs properly?
I don't think Jurgen would. I wish there was a way. I don't know if Jurgen Klinsmann would accept that. I don't know if Jurgen Klinsmann would say, I'm not going to manage the side anymore. I'm going to be the technical. Which I think in a perfect world would be splendid, because every defense of Jurgen Klinsmann begins with, hey, look at these guys he recruited, or hey, he's got a U-20 side that just played really well in New Zealand, or it's a defense of something that is more linked to the technical director aspect of the job. And the reality is that two of the more bad losses in the history of I don't want to say the history. Two of the more bad losses in the last 10 to 15 years of U.S. soccer have come with Jurgen Klinsmann as the manager. If there's a banner win, it's a game in Natal where the U.S. was on the back foot in a rainstorm. I just kind of gutted it out. And I don't think it's time to fire
the guy. By the way, I don't put a whole lot of possession statistics, as people know that listen to me for the years, but that's the that's the lowest possession a team that's ever won a World Cup match has had was the U.S.
And a lot of it had to do with the impossible decision about what to do when Josie Altidore pulled up lame.
Now that's when the game changed, right? I mean, the first 20 minutes, the U.S. were in control. Possession was about 50-50 or slightly in the U.S.'s favor, up a goal, and then obviously that changes your entire – you built your team around Altidore for the World Cup, and he's out for the tournament at that point. So maybe you give him a mulligan.
But that's – yeah, you give him a half mulligan because of roster selection, but let's not go down the Landon rabbit hole.
right. That's a subject – that's a topic for a previous day. We're done with
that. And look, I mean, I think some of this Klinsmann out stuff is premature. The U.S. won the 2013 Gold Cup. I thought Klinsmann with Landon Donovan, oh, by the way, managed that tournament masterfully. I thought that was some of the most fluid soccer in competition that the United States had ever played. And full credit to Jurgen Klinsmann for that. Because they won that tournament with Landon Donovan, they now have a chance to play in the Confederation Cup. Remember that for whatever the deal is with the rule change, Bob Bradley was essentially dispatched because they didn't get to play in the Confederations Cup and lost to Mexico at the Rose Bowl. So this is a big game. And, if the U.S. win that game, then I think it's hard to argue that Jurgen, the manager, shouldn't get the right to take the Americans into qualifying, because then it'll be a matter of what are your objectives? Your objectives were to get out of the group of death, accomplished. Your objectives were to qualify for the Confederations Cup, accomplished. So he'll be 2-for-2 at, like, in-game objectives, if that makes any sense.
It does, short-term objectives, but he's got responsibility for the long-term vision, and given that we have to go to a playoff game, whether he wins it or not, to qualify for the Confederations Cup, is it time then, if he's not going to relinquish the head coach duties, to force him to hire a really good number two tactical manager, someone who can do some of the in-game management that seems to be lacking with this program? And if it is that time, who's the one that forces Jurgen Klinsmann to do that?
Yeah, I mean, the second question is harder than the first. Because the answer to is it time to do that is it was time to do that when they brought in Bertie Vogts four months before Brazil. And in any country, as you very well know, in any other country other than the United States, that would have led SportsCenter. You know, whatever that country's SportsCenter is, you know, if Germany did that, it would have been the first story in the sports paper. It would have been the first story even in the English tabloids.
Even among American soccer fans, I think there was a lot of speculation, even up until before this Gold Cup, that, okay, Bertie's not managing Azerbaijan anymore. He still was when he was brought in right before the World Cup last year as a consultant. Maybe he's actually going to manage the team and Jurgen's going to go to the technical director spot. That hasn't happened, right? And it doesn't appear like it's going to happen. So then what's the process now of making something?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's been time to do that. Bertie Vogts is not the answer. It's not really my job to determine.
Right, if you want short-term results, maybe he's the answer. Cause other than the Scotland stint, he's got a very good record as a manager.
He does.
But it's not, again, if we're taking long-term objectives, you don't put a 70-year-old in this job.
No, and again, I don't have any problem with him assigning Herzog to get through Olympic qualifying. Obviously, Caleb Porter was a disaster. I feel like Porter has spent most of his time in Portland trying to make up for it.
Do you attribute Porter's appointment to directly to Klinsmann? That's an important question that a lot of people don't seem to want to answer.
You know, I mean, he was not the technical director.
Claudio Arena was, but it seemed like Porter was the American coach. He was still at Akron at the time, of course, that Klinsmann was most in love with, at least in his public
sense. Yeah, I mean, I think that was Jurgen's. I think that was probably Jurgen's call. That's, I mean,
my guess.
They hired Jurgen to make those kind of calls. And, you know, Porter's setup against Canada was terrible, and it was a disaster. The whole tournament was a disaster. And, you know, he's been fairly good in Portland. But you know, I don't have a problem with Herzog. And I think Tab Ramos just did an excellent job in New Zealand. I mean, the U.S. were very unfortunate not to be in the semifinals. And Serbia won, I believe.
Right. Serbia won the tournament. So the U.S. very easily could have been in the finals. Who knows? A lot of good performances there. So part two, who is the one who goes to Klinsmann and says you need to do this? Is Sunil Gulati hands-on enough or willing to challenge Klinsmann enough to do that? Or is it going to have to be something pressure that comes from the U.S. soccer press, much of which has been tuned out by Klinsmann and the USSF?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would have to be outside pressure, because it was interesting in the aftermath of the loss to Jamaica. I mean, Sunil Gulati attends a press conference, which is somewhat unusual, at least when I've been around the team. Usually when the team wins or loses, Gulati kind of stays in the hallway. But he comes in to hear what Jurgen has to say. And then really says immediately, pretty much the next day, oh, well, you know, we don't. It wasn't even a vote of confidence, because it wasn't as like cynical as that. It was just Jurgen's our guy and we're good. And, you know, Jurgen is Sunil's guy. Jurgen's not U.S. soccer's guy, but that's who Sunil chose to lead the team. That's who he wanted when he made Bob Bradley the interim manager. And now he's got his guy. So Sunil Gulati's probably not going to go and tell Jurgen Klinsmann, hey, you need to find a Yogi Löw, or I'm taking managerial power away from you. Because Jurgen will say, that's fine. You'll owe me a lot of money, and I'll go hang out in California with my kid.
Right, his kid, who of course I think he's now deleted his Twitter account, or at least isn't tweeting behind him Landon Donovan anymore. We're gonna get to the two big questions before we close the show in a minute, Neil. But first, let me tell you quickly, our listeners, about Ravel.tv. If you're enjoying this episode of Divers and Cheats, or if you've enjoyed any of the programs we've had on Ravel, it's time to give a shout out to the sponsor who's made this possible, Ravel.tv. If you're not familiar with Ravel, if you're listening to us live, you are. But if you're not familiar with Ravel, it's a completely new way of experiencing sports on TV. I know, Neil, you've done this as well as I have. If there's a game on television, you can mute the television and listen to our broadcast. The next time you want to watch your favorite soccer team on television, but you're tired of the announcers because you're biased against your team or simply aren't that good, press the mute button and then head over to Ravel.tv to listen to a real fan's audio broadcast of the game. So that means Liverpool fans who keep complaining about Tim Howard calling games because he's an Everton player, you can set up your own broadcast. And all the Liverpool fans can listen. If there isn't one broadcast available, you can create your own broadcast by switching on your mic and calling the match. It's easy. Sign up for free today and try it out at Ravel.tv. With Ravel, you can listen to broadcasts on your desktop, through your iOS app, and now through your mobile browser. Plus, you can join in the conversation by posting your questions or observations in the comments section. So take a moment today to thank our sponsor, Ravel.tv, for making this broadcast and all the broadcasts we have here via World Soccer Talk possible. Getting back to this subject, Neil, what is your sense about the tenability of Klinsmann's position should he lose this match? If he loses this playoff match to Mexico, is the heat so hot in the oven that he does step down from the head coach job and just does the technical director's job? Or do you think he doubles down? Or do you think there might be this reaction among U.S. soccer media and U.S. soccer fans that, okay, well, we didn't qualify, but now World Cup qualifying starts. Maybe we'll have the centenario next year. Maybe we won't. No worries. Let's just keep going. What's your thought about how the reaction will be if he loses?
Well, I think the two-part answer is there's one view that I would subscribe to, which would be it would be time to make a change, and that Klinsmann should be offered the opportunity to stay on as technical director, which I don't think he would accept, but I think that would be the – you know, I think in a soccer nation where the president of the federation wasn't so interlinked to the manager and the success of the hire of the manager, then that would probably be what happens. What I think will happen is that Klinsmann will be sent on in the World Cup qualifying, and that will be that. And that Sunil Gulati will identify it as a setback and say, hey, the goal of qualifying for Russia starts next month, and we feel like as a program we're headed in the right direction, and they'll point to the U-20s, and they'll likely point to a successful qualifying campaign at that point for the Olympics, which I think, you know, we certainly still have the players to qualify for the Olympics and to actually show fairly well there. You know, some of the U-20 guys are going to need to help the U-23s, but there's enough players to put on a good show in Rio. So I think the reality is there won't be a change. I think that
let me ask you real quickly about that and then keep going on this. Does that mean that everybody who is a eligible U-23 player for the United States, even if they're integrated into this full national team, like a Ventura Alvarado, should be called in for Olympic qualifying?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other tournament that Klinsmann put an emphasis on. When Caleb Porter failed, he said, we have to stop failing to qualify for these tournaments.
Okay.
They're absolutely essential. So that needs to happen. That's a referendum on him as a technical director, just like the U-20 tournament was, and he passed with sailing colors, or however that expression goes.
I think I just butchered.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only way Jurgen Klinsmann is fired, realistically, is if the actual qualifying campaign becomes problematic. And I know maybe that's a really cautionary view, but that's how much affection I think Sunil Gulati has for Jurgen Klinsmann and the idea of Jurgen Klinsmann.
Yeah, the idea being an important thing, because there's this notion of what he is, at least in Sunil's eyes, that may not have been borne out in reality.
There's a disconnect.
Yeah, clearly. And this vision goes back to 2006, after the 2006 World Cup, when Sunil courted him. So it's been a nine-year romance, even though the 4 years Klinsmann's been in the job may not necessarily bear out how Sunil had envisioned him. But nothing's always ideal. So taking Jurgen Klinsmann out of the picture now and just looking at the general program, if the U.S. fails to qualify for the Confederations Cup, and loses his playoff game to Mexico, would it be a disaster that sets the U.S. back for many years? Because since that 2011 Gold Cup final, also with the Rose Bowl, the U.S. has had the upper hand in CONCACAF over Mexico in terms of perception, in terms of level of play. Even, I think, in this Gold Cup, the general sense is Mexico, yeah, they won the Gold Cup, but they won it because of some screwy calls and some good luck, some really good luck. They didn't even win their group. The U.S. won their group. Trinidad won the group that Mexico was in. Feeling as Mexico... that they were very fortunate to beat Costa Rica and that they essentially stole the game from Panama. I mean, that mm-hmm. Panama won that game. Costa Rica didn't win the game against Mexico. It just could have gone either way if that call hadn't been made. But that essentially Panama beat Mexico. So there's still a perception that the United States might be better than Mexico, even though Costa Rica obviously got further than the United States or Mexico in the World Cup, and Jamaica got further than the United States in the Gold Cup. But we're taking Klinsmann out of this, but the United States loses to Mexico on home soil in a one-off competitive match, where does that leave the program? And it would be perceived as a disaster that it will take until maybe beating Mexico in the hex to get out of a year and a half later? I mean, how will it be perceived?
Yeah, I mean, it's a setback. I think we throw around these words like disaster or, failure. Even I used failure earlier a little too often, although I think my use of failure applied to the Gold Cup, which is accurate. It's a setback if the Americans don't win. It would be a loss to Mexico on home soil, regardless of the composition of the fan base. It would be the first loss to Mexico in 1,500 days. And it would be a chance to – it would be – yeah, I think it would signal sea change in the region. I know Paulo Wancho is no longer the manager of Costa Rica, but they'll find a manager and they'll get healthy around the same time.
And they're feeling the effects of letting Pinto go. Right? Let's face it, but maybe this is a do-over for them. Maybe this works out for them that Wancho's gone and they can find another Pinto.
Right? Yeah, well, the Wancho brawl is a windfall as opposed to the Herrera brawl is a disaster.
For Mexico, right.
Potentially one.
Right, one short thing. I think, let's face it, I think the Costa Rican Federation probably was looking for a way to get rid of him anyway. So
they have to be relieved. And now they'll get a chance to hire a manager that will have the full complement of players. And I think when you look at Costa Rica, you have to think the full complement of their players is probably, at least starting 11-wise, is the best starting 11 in CONCACAF, at least right now.
Correct, yes. I would agree with that.
And so, this is a chance for the U.S. to say, well, no, it's not, because not only did we take the Gold Cup in 2013, but now we're the Confederations Cup representative. And then you get a couple years for the Confederations Cup to see how a couple guys that are close develop. I mean, is Rubio Rubin a better player? Can Heinemann help you? I mean, there's a lot of how much do Brooks and Alvarado develop. So, it's an enormous game, and it's an interesting game because you're going to use veterans to kind of parlay a future tournament for your younger group that's going to be the group that leads you into Russia.
That's one of the dilemmas in international football always. We saw it with Bob Bradley hanging on to a couple of guys in 2009, Frankie Haydock and Connor Casey and Brian Ching in order to qualify, but had no intention of taking any of those guys to the World Cup. That's just one of the dilemmas. You qualify with veterans, and then when the tournament comes, the big event comes, you spring kids. And that's just been the cycle with U.S. soccer. I think Stevie Ralston played in the most games in qualifying for the 2006 World Cup and then wasn't taken to the tournament by Bruce Arena. Is that something Jurgen Klinsmann subscribes to? Does he subscribe to the idea that you can qualify with one set of guys and then take another set of guys to a World Cup or to a Confederations Cup? Or is he is this the time, having failed at the Gold Cup, and I know we're throwing around words like failure, right? But he did fail at the Gold Cup with largely a veteran squad, except for the two center backs. Is this when he bloodlets the kids? I mean, are we going to see a Rubio Rubin in this game? Are we going to see a Jordan Morris in this game? Are we going to see an Emerson Hyndman in this game? Is it possible that those guys are going to actually feature against Mexico?
Gosh, I wouldn't think so. Rubio Rubin would be the only guy that I think could play. And that's just because the U.S. situation at forward is dire.
Right.
You know, it's just a giant help wanted sign. I don't think Jordan Morris coming off some surgery and just getting his legs back under him in the Pac-12 gauntlet. You throw out there for the Confederations Cup playoff match. So no,
on
I don't
the West
think
Coast
so.
At least.
Yeah, it's not a very far drive. It's not too far, I guess. But you know, what's interesting is the first question about, you know, sort of Klinsmann's loyalty, because he was relatively loyal with his squad selection for Brazil. I mean, save Julian Green and John Brooks.
DeAndre Yedlin.
Yeah, and DeAndre Yedlin. It was a relatively predictable,
We mentioned Brad Davis. I mean, that was a funny one. I mean, I never thought I'd see that guy play for the U.S. in the World Cup, and he was one of those guys that said, okay, he's in qualifying, but he'll never be on a World Cup squad, and sure. Klinsmann took him. Graham Zusi, even though I think we thought maybe the World Cup was beyond a guy like Zusi. So he basically stuck with the same team with those, except for those three young players we mentioned.
Yeah, and thank God he took Graham Zusi, because there wasn't anybody else that gets the ball to John Brooks and Natal. You know, somebody has to deliver that ball.
Right.
So he was relatively loyal. You know, I thought Bob Bradley was relatively loyal as well. But Bob had less to work with in terms of just size of player pool.
Yeah. Yeah, and after the Charlie Gavies accident, the forward situation was thrown into tumult, and the U.S. never solved that. The U.S. did not solve that situation during the remainder of Bradley's tenure. You could argue it still hasn't been solved. But Bradley started trying various forwards.
He did, and he tried ones that made sense, to his credit. He tried players that fit the counterattacking style of play that he wanted. But,
like Jeff Cunningham, you know, Edson Bunnell, et cetera.
The U.S. scored two of the most technically beautiful goals probably in Federation history with Bob Bradley as their manager. One against Brazil in the Confederations Cup final, and one against Mexico at Azteca. And those goals involved Charlie Davies, and there's a reason that, you know, there's a reason it was difficult to replace him. Before the accident, he was just a really brilliant counterattacking piece for Bradley. Jurgen Klinsmann, as a pragmatist, doesn't really have that type of indispensable player, except, of course, he did at the World Cup last year, which is why he's such a mysterious manager.
Yes, and maybe he creates pressure points on purpose with some of these players. Which is go ahead.
Right. No, I was going to say, yeah, I'm right.
It seems his public comments are always designed for some sort of reaction. So, Neil, thank you for being with us. And for those of you who've been listening here on Rabble.tv and World Soccer Talk, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week, same time, same place, 6 p.m. Eastern. Again, sorry for the slight technical glitch that got us started 3 or 4 minutes late today. Here at Rabble.tv and World Soccer Talk, 6 p.m. next Thursday, another episode of Divers and Cheats. Enjoy your weekend of football, whether it be in NASL or MLS or the Premier League or the Bundesliga starting tomorrow with Bayern Munich on Fox Sports 2 or any other league around the world. So once again, I'm Curtis Krishnire, and enjoy your football.